Chapter 42. One could faintly discern the windows and chimneys, and a dull blur of lights. Our first emotion was deep unutterable gratitude. Our next was a foolish rage, born of the suspicion that possibly the hotel had been visible 3/4 of an hour while we sat there in those cold puddles quarreling. Yes, it was the Rye G. Combe Hotel, the one that occupies the extreme summit, and whose remote little sparkle of lights we had often seen glinting high aloft among the stars from our balcony away down yonder in Lucerne. The crusty portier and the crusty clerks gave us the surly reception which their kind deal out in prosperous times, but by mollifying them with an extra display of obsequiousness and servility we finally got them to show us to the room which our boy had engaged for us. We got into some dry clothing, and while our supper was preparing we loafed forsakenly through a couple of vast cavernous drawing rooms, one of which had a stove in it. This stove was in a corner, and densely walled around with people. We could not get near the fire, so we moved at large in idiotic spaces, among a multitude of people who sat silent, smileless, forlorn, and shivering, thinking what fools they were to come, perhaps. There were some Americans and some Germans, but one could see that the great majority were English. We lounged into an apartment, where there was a great crowd, to see what was going on. It was a memento magazine. The tourists were eagerly buying all sorts and styles of paper cutters, marked Alvener of the Rye G, with handles made of the little curved horn of the ostensible chamois. There were all manner of wooden goblets and such things, similarly marked. I was going to buy a paper cutter, but I believed I could remember the cold comfort of the Rye G comb without it, so I smothered the impulse. Supper warmed us, and we went immediately to bed, but first, as Mr. Baedeker requests all tourists to call his attention to any errors which they may find in his guidebooks, I dropped him a line to inform him he missed it by just about 3 days. I had previously informed him of his mistake about the distance from Allerheiligen to Oppene, and had also informed the Ordnance Department of the German government of the same error in the imperial maps. I will add, here, that I never got any answer to those letters, or any thanks from either of those sources, and, what is still more discourteous, these corrections have not been made, either in the maps or the guidebooks. But I will write again when I get time, for my letters may have miscarried. We curled up in the clammy beds, and went to sleep without rocking. We were so sodden with fatigue, that we never stirred nor turned over till the blooming blasts of the Alpine horn aroused us. It may well be imagined that we did not lose any time. We snatched on a few odds and ends of clothing, cocooned ourselves in the proper red blankets, and plunged along the halls, and out into the whistling wind bareheaded. We saw a tall wooden scaffolding on the very peak of the summit, 100 yards away, and made for it. We rushed up the stairs to the top of this scaffolding, and stood there, above the vast outlying world, with hair flying and ruddy blankets waving and cracking in the fierce breeze. 15 minutes too late, at last, said Harris, in a vexed voice. The sun is clear above the horizon. No matter, I said, it is a most magnificent spectacle, and we will see it do the rest of its rising anyway. In a moment we were deeply absorbed in the marvel before us, and dead to everything else. The great cloud-barred disk of the sun stood just above a limitless expanse of tossing white caps, so, to speak, a billowy chaos of massy mountain domes and peaks draped in imperishable snow, and flooded with an opaline glory of changing and dissolving splendors, while through rifts, in a black cloud bank above the sun, radiating lances of diamond dust shot to the zenith. The cloven valleys of the lower world swam in a tinted mist which veiled the ruggedness of their cracks and rips and ragged forests, and turned all the forbidding region into a soft and rich and sensuous paradise. We could not speak. We could hardly breathe. We could only gaze in drunken ecstasy and drink in it. Presently Harris exclaimed, "Why, nation, it's going down!" Perfectly true. We had missed the morning horn blow and slept all day. This was stupefying. Harris said, "Look here, the sun isn't the spectacle it's US stacked up here on top of this gallows, in these idiotic blankets, and 250 well-dressed men and women down here gawking up at us, and not caring a straw whether the sun rises or sets, as long as they've got such a ridiculous spectacle as this to set down in their memorandum books. They seem to be laughing their ribs loose, and there's one girl there that appears to be going all to pieces. I never saw such a man as you before. I think you are the very last possibility in the way of an ass. What have I done?" I answered, with heat. "What have you done? You've got up at 7:30 in the evening to see the sun rise, that's what you've done. And have you done any better, I'd like to know? I've always used to get up with the lark, till I came under the petrifying influence of your turgid intellect. You used to get up with the lark, oh, no doubt you'll get up with the hangman one of these days. But you ought to be ashamed to be jawing here like this, in a red blanket, on a 40-foot scaffold on top of the Alps. And no end of people down here to boot, this isn't any place for an exhibition of temper." And so the customary quarrel went on. When the sun was fairly down, we slipped back to the hotel in the charitable gloaming, and went to bed again. We had encountered the horn blower on the way, and he had tried to collect compensation, not only for announcing the sunset, which we did see, but for the sunrise, which we had totally missed. But we said no, we only took our solar rations on the European plan, pay for what you get. He promised to make us hear his horn in the morning, if we were alive. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.